We're starting a show now called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com. On today's show, a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone, followed by a talk by Dr. Justin Sledge from the YouTube channel Esoterica. Then I have an extended essay on the New Age, and we feature beautiful music by Akerke. Stay tuned.
Ennio Morricone and Charlie Daniels both died recently. I see a lot about Charlie, so I will not comment other than to say he was a nice guy when I met him. Ennio Morricone meant a lot to me. His compositions and movie soundtracks are literally the soundtrack to my life. I have been a film fanatic since I was a kid going to the Rama Theater in Warner Robins, Georgia for a short, a movie, a cartoon, popcorn, and a Coke for 25 cents. Morricone worked with everyone from Danger Mouse to Metallica to the Pet Shop Boys. He won 3 Grammys, 3 Golden Globes, 6 BAFTAs, and a lot of other awards. The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, La Cage aux Folles, Once Upon a Time in the West, Days of Heaven, The Mission, The Untouchable, Cinema Paradiso, The Hateful Eight. The list goes on and on. Morricone was a music machine. He turned out score after score after score. If there is another Academy Award show, rest assured there will be a segment dedicated to Morricone. When my son Ari was at Santa Monica High School, they wanted to perform a Morricone composition at one of their performances. There was no luck in finding this score anywhere. I even called some of my old record business contacts in Italy. No luck. It seemed that the maestro would not lease his scores out unless he was the conductor. I could not imagine how he could have come to Santa Monica High School to conduct a high school symphony, albeit one of the best in America. The music department of heaven just got a lot better with the addition of Morricone as a composer-conductor. Funny side story. I love the score to Once Upon a Time in America. I still do. I'm listening to it as I type this. It can and does bring me to tears. When I was president of Mercury Records, I wanted to get a copy of the CD for my collection, but for some reason, the title had been deleted or cut out. It was probably because it was not a big enough seller. That happens. My head of sales told me to go over to Colony Records in Times Square. They would have an import of it. So I walked over to Colony Records after work and inquired about it. I did not introduce myself, no business card to the guy at the front desk, nothing like that. The gentleman behind the counter said yes, he had it in stock. He brought it out and said the price was $35. I sort of blanched at the price and said something. His response was, "Hey, you're the idiots that cut it out. I should charge you $70, end quote. You gotta love New York, and so help me God, that's a true story.
If the Renaissance could be said to have had a battle cry, it was Ad Fontes, back to the sources. To the mind of many thinkers of that period, culture and its vicissitudes had undergone a long period of degradation under the influence of Gothic barbarity and scholastic obscurantism. It was therefore the task of the day to recover truth and beauty at their ancient and therefore most pure sources. And in the 1460s, one of those sources was thought to have been rediscovered. In a manuscript bearing a tight, though legible, Greek minuscule hand, appeared to be primordial wisdom stretching back to the most remote antiquity. Indeed, the source of all wisdom itself. The task of rendering that Greek into Latin was given to the extremely talented scholar Marsilio Ficino. And most famously, he interrupted his own translation of Plato's complete works to take up the task. Ficino, only in his late 20s at the time, began the work of translating what he believed, and many at the time also believed, was the teaching of the sages of all sages, perhaps the teacher of Moses himself, the arch-philosopher and hierophant Hermes Trismegistus. The texts Ficino produced have become the backbone of what we now know as the Corpus Hermeticum, the collected wisdom and teachings attributed to the thrice great Hermes. These texts have gone on to become synonymous with Western esotericism and mystical insight itself. But just what are they, and what do they actually teach? Are they indeed the font of all wisdom? In this episode of Esoterica, we're going to provide an introduction to the Corpus Hermeticum, we're going to explore the teachings found in these texts, explore their history, and talk a bit about how one might go about studying these texts in greater depth. I'm Dr. Justin Sledge, and welcome to Esoterica, where we explore the arcane side of history, philosophy, and religion. When Ficino's Latin translation of the Corpus Hermeticum hit the incunable presses in 1471, it was an immediate success, going into some two dozen editions over the next 150 years. The text was heralded as the uncorrupted font from which flowed the biblical teachings of Moses, but also Greek philosophy. In Hermes Trismegistus, Jerusalem and Athens had a common parent. But just what is this literature? The Hermetica is somewhat artificially divided into two camps by modern scholars. On the one hand, there's the technical Hermetica, which includes a wide range of literature including alchemy, astrology, botany, magic, and so forth, all ascribed to Hermes Trismegistus and his disciples. This literature had an enormously long half-life and survived through the Greco-Egyptian period, into the Islamic period, and into the early medieval European traditions. Perhaps the most famous instance of this literature is the so-called Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus, a text produced during the Islamic period. Sadly, most of this literature hasn't been given a treatment in contemporary scholarship, but I'll be doing a separate episode just on the technical Hermetica at some point in the future, so stay tuned for that. On the other hand, there is what is called the Philosophical Hermetica. Ficino rendered 14 brief tractates. The original 1471 edition was so slim that it could be bound with other texts. And this represented the lion's share of the body of the Greek philosophical literature traditionally ascribed to the legendary magus Hermes Trismegistus, or Hermes the thrice great and his disciples. So now that we have some categories, let's go ahead and just mess those up. What should be stressed at this point is the difference between the technical Hermetica and the philosophical Hermetica is anything other than rigid. It's a basically modern construct that doesn't fit easily upon ancient writings. For instance, the Alexandrian philosopher Zosimos of Panopolis glides easily between the technical Hermetica and the philosophical Hermetica in his writings on alchemy, proving that ancient peoples don't really give a damn about modern scholarly categories. Further, and more to the point I think, I find this distinction problematic because it allows modern prejudices to sneak into scholarship. While the philosophical Hermetica have been given a proper scholarly treatment, much of the technical Hermetica still languishes in obscurity. I suspect this reflects a bias to what is perceived as scholarly and respectable. In this case, philosophy is seen as respectable, whereas the world of astrology, alchemy, and magic are seen as something otherwise. Therefore, the academy allows for the publication of philosophical texts, but is still profoundly prejudiced against the others. Of course, scholarship should be scholarship, and to my mind, we should give both equal weight. Regardless, these two categories are still somewhat helpful, even if they are fundamentally problematic. And in this episode, we're going to be focusing primarily on the philosophical Hermetica. As we have it now, the Corpus Hermeticum is made up of about 20 principal Greek tractates, a longer text in Latin called the Asclepius, a digest of definitions preserved in Armenian, a couple of brief texts that were recovered from the Nag Hammadi library in Egypt, fragmentary tractates preserved in the teaching text of Stobaeus, along with numerous shorter fragments and testimonia preserved in writers from the late classical period and beyond. To be sure, what has come down to us is only a fraction of what surely must have existed, and it's passed through what I call the Byzantine filter, which I'll talk more about in just a moment. A clue to how much has been lost may be found in the Nag Hammadi library. There we have a scribal note disclaiming themselves for not including more Hermetic literature, because they weren't sure if the compiler wanted them. There's an important lesson here, and that lesson is simple. Just assume that everybody wants more Hermetic literature. Not counting what's been lost simply to the vicissitudes of time and chance, the Corpus Hermeticum has also passed through what I call the Byzantine filter. What I mean by that is Greek texts passed through the hands of Byzantine editors at some point, and it's quite clear that those editors had a very complicated relationship with the Corpus Hermeticum. It is likely that the texts that have come down to us are the ones most amenable, or at least least offensive, to Christianity. Indeed, Christianity has had a long, complicated relationship with the Hermetica that I'll be discussing in just a moment. And lastly, what's come down to us doesn't seem to have come down to us systematically. It appears that the Hermetic texts were graded based on some initiation process that is now unclear to us. What we now possess seems to be texts at various, seemingly random, levels of this process. So it's unclear how these texts should be read, in what order, or even after what kind of initiatory or revelatory experiences. Despite all this, what unifies the texts is that they are based around the teachings of Hermes Trismegistus and his disciples. As early as Herodotus, Hermes is linked with the Egyptian god of magic and writing, Thoth, and this relationship had become concretized by the period of the Greek colonization of Egypt. What emerges in the Greco-Roman-Egyptian context is a heavily syncretistic culture, and by extension, a syncretistic religious worldview. This syncretism can be seen in many registers of Egyptian life at this period. Perhaps one of the most dramatic is to be found in the magical practices of late classical Egypt. I've made an entire separate episode on the Greek magical papyri if you're interested, so make sure to check that out as well. It is this context in the first few centuries of the Common Era that produced the texts of the Corpus Hermeticum as we know them. The combination of Hermes and Thoth was a natural fit, and the epithet, thrice great, seems to have an ancient Egyptian pedigree. The philosophical Hermetica are typically structured as discourses between Hermes and his pupils, though Corpus Hermeticum I is taken to be a discourse between divine nous, or mind, and Hermes Trismegistus himself. The content of the discourses range enormously, despite their relative brevity, from the nature of the cosmos, to the origin and nature of evil, to the process of change, the nature of the mind and the soul, the very origins of the cosmos itself, and most importantly, the process by which one can achieve salvation. Sometimes a single tractate may cover several of these topics only in a couple of pages. The best theory we have as to the origins of the text is that they began as brief sentences, much like the wisdom literature of the indigenous Egyptian culture. And around these sentences grew a history of learned exposition. These discourses, as I mentioned earlier, were probably part of a system of graded lessons, for initiates passing higher and higher to what seems to have been the goal of the Hermetic philosophy, the salvific unification of the initiate's mind slash soul with the divine mind or soul that is the ground of being itself. Indeed, the Corpus Hermeticum reminds me a bit of the Upanishads, both in style and in content. The worldview of the Hermetica is difficult to reconstruct, but let's give it a try. They appear to have held that an androgyne divine mind begat the cosmos, sometimes called the second god or logos, and in turn created human beings, which are seen as both divine and non-divine, given that they are both composed of perishable matter and imperishable soul or mind. This is basically a monistic worldview, although some anti-body dualism does appear from time to time. The apparent task of the initiate is to ascend through the planetary spheres, through both ethical purity and mental contemplation, until reunited with the divine oneness, which seems in some sense possible while still in a physical body. This importantly separates the Hermetists from the Gnostics, who are typically held to be radical dualists, viewing the physical world as fundamentally evil and in need of escape. Importantly, the Hermetic practice was not only philosophical, but also sensible and empirical. One begins one's ascent by recognizing the beauty of creation as the work of the Creator, who is beauty itself. Since the divine is immanent to the cosmos is, by extension, eternal and filled with intelligences, gods, and daimons, who all act as part of the cosmic harmony through sympathetic relations. Evil is fundamentally thought to be a privation, insofar as the divine is the sole source of goodness. Death is thought to be simply physical dissolution, with life and mind being eternal. As the Corpus Hermeticum reminds us, the One is in all and all is in the One. In addition to these philosophical beliefs, it is also clear that they're what we would now call religious practices, such as the tradition of Egyptian statue animation, religious meals and kissing, the singing of hymns, and possible mantra-like chants to aid the initiate, some of which survive in the Corpus Hermeticum. This is also why I'm somewhat remiss to refer to these purely as philosophical Hermetica. From a strictly philosophical point of view, these texts aren't terribly extraordinary for their time. Virtually all of the philosophical heavy lifting in the Corpus Hermeticum seems to basically be ideas that can be found in Middle Platonism and the Middle Stoa. It's also clear that the Hermeticists are borrowing from Jewish sources as well. This is unsurprising given the enormous Jewish diaspora in the city of Alexandria at this time. Of course, the problem here isn't with the Hermetica, it's with us. In the ancient world, philosophy carried with it a much more robust sense. It was certainly more than simply justified true beliefs arrived at by rational argumentation, but rather it was a total way of being in the world. Philosophy was a way of life in the ancient world. What makes the Corpus Hermeticum extraordinary, and what may also explain many of the internal inconsistencies, lack of logical rigor, and apparently superficial treatment of highly technical philosophical problems, is that the priority of the Hermetica is soteriological. That is to say, it has to do primarily with salvation rather than producing a rigorous philosophical system. This is philosophy in the service of salvation. And to misunderstand that priority is to fundamentally misunderstand the Corpus Hermeticum. This may also help us understand how much of this religio-philosophical culture was a result of indigenous Egyptian influence. While a previous generation of scholars felt that the indigenous Egyptian influence was marginal, maybe just window dressing, recent scholarship has shown that at the literary level, a great deal of Egyptian idiom survives, but also much of the overtly religious practice probably has its origins in religious temple culture. Further, and I think this is also very important, anti-Greek language sentiment is preserved in the Corpus Hermeticum, ironically in Greek, and a prophecy about the dangers of colonialism is preserved in the Latin Aesculapius. While the Corpus Hermeticum is a result of a cultural syncretism, it also contains a protest against the reality of both Greek and Roman colonization, occupation, and appropriation. And this is to me what is fascinating and impressive about the Corpus Hermeticum. It produces a worldview by combining Egyptian religious practice with Greek philosophical speculation to produce a synthesis that must have been truly innovative in its time, if only a minority movement. Sadly, we're left with a very one-sided glimpse of this movement. At least part of what they thought has survived, but how they practiced seems to have been largely lost to history. So how did these essentially pagan texts survive the rise of the monotheisms? Well, surprisingly, because of them. As you may know, Christianity had a bit of a PR problem early on. It was a new religion. And new and religion made very little sense in the Greco-Egyptian-Roman context. Religions were, by definition, old. Even Judaism, a religion the Romans held with a great deal of suspicion, still demanded respect because of its perceived great antiquity. But the Jesus movement, with its leader not only crucified, but crucified like last week, only made the religion appear more aberrant in the eyes of the average Roman. So many early Christian theologians and writers sought to link the coming of Christ with ancient figures and texts. And one such strategy that emerged, such as that found in Lactantius, was to link the coming of Christ with the Corpus Hermeticum, thus making Hermes Trismegistus a kind of pre-Christian Christian. This may also explain why the Corpus Hermeticum survives primarily in Eastern Christian centers, was more amenable to Hermes Trismegistus, the Western writer Augustine was certainly not. This, at some level, given the great influence of Augustine in the Western Christian world, sealed the Corpus Hermeticum's fate in the Latin West. Until, of course, our great hero Ficino comes along, so back to him. As I mentioned earlier, the 1471 translation of the Corpus Hermeticum was a splash and ran into 24 editions by a century later. Further Hermetic writings were discovered, and Hermeticism enjoyed a kind of renaissance all its own, in the thought of people like Giordano Bruno and Ludovico Lazzarelli. Interestingly, the ideas of the Corpus Hermeticum do not have seemed to have had a huge impact on Ficino himself. The Hermetic seed of the existence of an ancient perennial philosophy, or Prisca Theologia, would survive Isaac Casaubon's solid argument that the Corpus Hermeticum dated to the first few centuries of the Common Era, and therefore could not be that ancient primal source of wisdom. Of course, people aren't going to let facts get in the way of the truth, and so move the origins of wisdom east, and then to Atlantis, and then through the Akashic Records, or to the collective unconscious. Needless to say, the Corpus Hermeticum has had a singular impact on the development of Western esotericism, though less, I think, in its actual contents, but more in its metonymic value. The Corpus Hermeticum represents ancient perennial wisdom, the dream of a spiritual monism to combat the dualism many of us perceive, and the ascent of the soul to the unity of being itself. That the Corpus Hermeticum has had a symbolic rather than literary impact may be especially true given that recent scholarship has shown that Ficino's Latin translation of the Corpus Hermeticum was profoundly flawed. So much so that subsequent editions tried to fix his Latin translation, only further confusing the text and separating its readers from the original Greek text. The mystery of the truth is almost always more powerful than the truth behind the mystery. If you want a solid understanding of the philosophical components of the Corpus Emeticum, you're going to have to do a little work. To get a handle on this material, the main sources you'll need are Middle Platonism and Middle Stoicism. Here the main figures are probably Plutarch, Numenius of Apamea, and Philo of Alexandria on the Middle Platonism side, along with Posidonius and Panaetius on the Middle Stoicism side. John Dylan's book on the Middle Platonists here is essential reading if you really want to grasp the Corpus Hermeticum and all of its philosophical complexity. Now, this may be somewhat controversial, but I don't see much in the way of Neoplatonic influences directly on the Corpus Hermetica itself. This would make some sense given the time period in which it was composed, especially if you think it was composed more on the closer side to the turn of the Common Era rather than later. For instance, the monad in the Corpus Hermeticum is a begetter or creator god rather than an emanator deity, and there really isn't much in the way of the kind of Baroque hypostatic entities that one detects in later Neoplatonic ideas. And to my knowledge, Plotinus himself only mentions Hermes once in the entire Enneads, despite him being born and philosophically and religiously trained in Egypt. So while Neoplatonic ideas have had an enormous impact on later Western esotericism, I don't think they're to be found natively in the Corpus Hermeticum. Of course, if you want to study the Corpus Hermeticum, the standard text is by Copenhaver, with his very fine introduction and wonderful commentary. If you're interested in Hermetic philosophy, alchemy, mysticism, magic, and the occult, this is all core content here at Esoterica. Until next time, I'm Dr. Justin Sledge, and you've been watching Esoterica, where we explore the arcane side of history, philosophy, and religion.
That was Dr. Justin Sledge giving a talk on a work called The Corpus Hermeticum. He's got a wonderful YouTube channel called Esoterica that I highly recommend. In a few minutes, I'm doing an extended essay about the New Age and wellness community. This is certainly the religion, if you will, that I emerged from, and I am grateful for what I received from it. Yoga, meditation, self-reflection, healing arts, and opening my mind to mystical abilities like astral travel, seeing auras, past lives, and such. The first part of this essay I wrote over a decade ago. The last part I just wrote, the section where I sound totally disgusted with my community, and you'll see why. But I'd like to introduce you to a dear friend and colleague, Akerke Shaktikova. We met at a freeform Sunday ecstatic dance event in West Los Angeles a couple years ago. I had done the closing sound meditation with Cello, and we connected afterwards. A few weeks later, Akerke had to return to her home country, Kazakhstan. We've been communicating ever since through our internet computers. When the last Borat movie was released a couple of months ago, she was not pleased to see this creation resurface, who allegedly comes from Kazakhstan. I'd like all my listeners to know that not only do the Kazakh people look nothing like Borat, they act nothing like him either. Borat is presented as a caricature of an uncouth foreigner. But more truthfully, Borat is us. Borat is the ugly American. We laugh at him, but we're really laughing at a part of ourselves. If you are ever lucky enough to meet Akerke, you will be in the presence of an actual Kazakh who is one of the most gracious, graceful, creative, and intelligent people you will ever meet. You are about to hear her extraordinary voice, and you may, as I did upon listening, immediately fall in love. She's as lovely a person as the lovely music she spontaneously improvises. The angels of the New Age aren't necessarily found anymore at the consciousness expos. Hey. Spiritual but Not Religious by Mystic Pete. As many as 48% of the people in the United States call themselves Spiritual but Not Religious, or SBNR for short. This is different from BDSM or OMFG. The spiritual but not religious may be disenchanted with traditional religions that require us to just believe instead of thinking for ourselves, be dogmatic and narrow-minded instead of having dynamic, visionary spiritual experiences, spread hatred and intolerance, ally with the privileged and powerful against the vulnerable and those in need, constrain sexuality and judge others, and suck the fun out of life. A fair number of SBNR people have beliefs stemming from New Age philosophy. Let me identify a few issues that we of the New Age are facing. First, the name makes people cringe, so wellness community has generally been swapped in. Next, new converts to any religion or faith tend to be zealous. Every New Age person is a new convert because New Age is, well, new. People get excited when they find fresh insights and original truth, not least of which is the vision that we must collectively go through spiritual renewal. However, along with exciting discovery comes a fervency that can be off-putting to everybody else. Adherents may see the answers they have found as the only answers. This leads to some very judgmental New Age people. You aren't drinking structured water? What is structured water anyway? Until recently, with its romance with cults and its recent wedding to QAnon, more about that later, probably the most dangerous part of the New Age is the extremist diets, particularly raw food veganism. While questioning old habits and dietary exploration are the bread and butter of consciousness pioneering, people have gone bananas. I have many raw vegan friends who are trying to starve themselves to purity. The thing that is so comforting to the body and nutritious, cooked foods served hot, they deny themselves and may even consider poisonous. Something about the rigor of this diet feels devout, but all they're doing is destroying their health. I'm a fair medical intuitive, and I can see how things look on people's insides. Yeah, okay, that's what I do. These dieters usually have osteoporotic bones, all demineralized and on the way to becoming crumbly saltine crackers. I don't know why low-protein diets make the bones and teeth go first, but I can see this with my own third eye. Youth is the next thing to go. These people age very quickly. Look, if you do a raw veggie diet for a couple weeks, once in a while, you'll probably feel great. But don't turn eating into a military assault. Take food with a grain of salt. Wouldn't it be nice if we could hopscotch over millions of years of physical evolution and presto changeo, transmogrify into light beings that thrive only on raw vegetables, fruit, or juice, or even just air? That's actually called breatharianism, or just sunlight. We have sun gazers. We have people actually trying to draw in the sun's nutrition through their, taint. To round out the mutation, we could genetically modify our spleens to manufacture chlorophyll, giving our skin a pleasant green hue. The fact is, DNA and our ability to extract nutrition from food does not change overnight. Darn reality. Dietary consecration will happen, but it will take a while for our biology to catch up with our idealism. Well-being comes from home-cooked meals enjoyed with loved ones. Along these lines is the slow foods movement. Eat the way your great-grandparents ate, homemade and locally grown. Or try eating insects. Nothing beats eating insects. Absent a bona fide nutrition-related ailment, micromanaging your food intake is a recipe for anxiety. A few minutes of eating worry will hurt you more than actually eating practically any horrible forbidden food, say a chocolate dip cream puff. Avoid diets. Don't sweat over superfoods unless you're Superman or have a perspiration problem. In the 1960s, the establishment looked at brown rice like it was a communist plot. However, nowadays, the scientific establishment's dietary recommendations are usually right on. Next problem. If food psychosis is the most dangerous thing about the New Age, advice giving is the most obnoxious. Who are you to correct someone's thoughts or language or teach them how to live? You're saying, I know better than you what's good for you. Unsolicited advice is presumptuous, if not insulting. Because of the New Age focus on self-help and therapy, we want to help others by recommending what helped us. We're caring and empathic and genuinely desire to make people feel better. But giving unsolicited advice is usually an attempt to boost our own ego by acting authoritative. If you want to occasionally offer guidance, best to first say, may I make a suggestion? Ask, don't tell. Or better yet, just witness. Be a good friend by being a good listener, not by trying to change people. My favorite is when I tell a joke and a New Age advice giver, thinking my self-deprecating humor is a cry for help, tries to solve me. Here's my joke. I'm so fed up with the world that I'm going to become a Jewish Muslim extremist and change my name to Muhammad Shlomovitz. New Age response. Have you tried eliminating dairy? Ever meet a New Age caricature who has to turn every negative statement into a positive one? This may make those with poor self-esteem actually feel worse, because in contrast, it highlights their gloomy reality. Debbie Downer. BPA, flame retardant, pesticides, and other exotic man-made substances are streaming through our blood. Peggy Positive. Cancel, cancel, cancel. All of God's chemical secretions heal my body temple, and Mother, Father, Universe nourishes every cell of my supreme being and becoming. Interestingly, pessimistic people may fare better during times of adversity, because they're better prepared for it. You may not like negative people, but you've got to love them. Don't freak out over what I'm about to tell you. In general, saying or thinking bad things doesn't make bad things happen. And by themselves, saying or thinking good things doesn't make good things happen. Easy does it now. Put down the sage and step away from the vegetable grater. The positive speak talkers have a mistaken belief about what makes things come true, about using mystical principles to pull things out of the imagination and manifest them on earth. It's not what you think. New Agers aren't going to like this one bit, but the truth is, thoughts and words have little power in the mere thinking or uttering. Ever run into older folks who are habitually negative? In past generations, people believed that if the devil heard you boasting, he'd take away whatever you were so happy about. And making favorable observations tempted fate. From this, we get the practice of knocking on wood or saying a protection spell like God willing. Even today, few would jinx themselves by making a statement like, I think I've just met my soulmate. In the old days, you'd get the same reaction from saying, I'm so blessed, my life is perfect, as you would from cracking a loud fart in a packed elevator. People also believed that by complaining and making evident their wretched, deserving condition, they might reap God's favor. So back then, if you said good things, you'd get bad things. And if you said bad things, you might get good things. To what consequence? Even though few spoke positively, people fell in love, had families, and accomplished great achievements. Civilization still got built. We now have the opposite superstition. You get what you wish for, meaning whatever you say or think will come true, leading believers to try to control their minds so only positive thoughts waft through. Like our grandparents, once we believe something, we usually maintain that belief till death do us part. I've got friends who've tried to positively think themselves to success for years, and nothing ever changes in their lives, except expenditures on headache medicine. They've invested too much energy holding up this wobbly pillar of New Age thought to consider it may be horse feathers. And furthermore, since so many other people believe it, it must be true. Every religion is similarly encumbered. I'm of the persuasion that inner reality creates outer reality. That's why I open inner doors to open outer doors. The spiritual world begets the physical world. However, what fetches things out of the imagination and materializes them on earth is not really what you think about, but what you do and how you be. What else could account for the popularity of the Doobie Brothers? Integrated people think and talk about everything imaginable and the full range of emotions, both light and dark. Powerful mystics especially so. Take the gag out of your mouth and the clamp off your brain and speak and think whatever you want. The more creative, the better. Also, be here now if you can figure out exactly where you are. To investigate for yourself, try this experiment. If you're under the positive speak spell, see the glass half empty for a week. If an anvil falls on your head, I'll send you a free t-shirt. Concluding this topic, I want to make a distinction. Some are afraid of speaking negative words, as if just speaking certain syllables has malign incantatory power. To which I say, for Mystic Pete's sake, relax. Far different is using words invested with meaning and intention followed by action, the force of which can be seen by the malicious deed done on January 6th. Why is the New Age mocked? Because our ideology can sound like we learned it in kindergarten, basically saying, be nice. I'm all for being nice. Being nice is a nice thing to be. Every religion and philosophy since we came out of the trees has said as much. Is this all we got? Also, success seminars have stressed acting confident. But a psychopath can be confident. Something feels phony about the smiley faces these seminars suggest we wear. Competence and down-to-earth caring are more worthy attributes to cultivate than feigned confidence. Lastly, much of the New Age has been monetized. Struggling New Agers try to pay their rent selling supplements, ancient philosophies, and newfangled devices. Claims are exaggerated. Longtime friends and alleged holy men sting you with the sales pitch. Improve your sex life, get rich, and protect yourself from radiation by washing your clothes with my pyramid-shaped rhino turds. While we are not entirely sure what the New Age movement is, one thing is for sure, fringe nuttiness and unsubstantiated claims embarrass us, as do prosperity coaches who are themselves broke. Come up with radical theories. Unless unquestioningly believed, even crackpot notions don't make us dumber. And certainly, creative thinking brightens awareness. But state theories as theories, not as truth. Instead of attacking journalists and scientists, look to them as the truth tellers they are. New Age people do have answers that may solve world problems. However, for others to take us seriously, we must stop taking ourselves so seriously. We must question fanciful beliefs. Stop giving people unwanted advice. Be careful about making money off spiritual technology. And learn to laugh at ourselves. I knew the New Age was starting to spoil. When I had to ask my last girlfriend to remove the large crystals from her bed so I could have a place to sleep, I assured her several times that an actual male made a better sleeping companion than pointy stones. Now to the recent New Age monster that's reared its ugly head. I had mentioned that there was something more dangerous than the debilitating diets. New Age cultism has now turned deeply sinister. I guess this was inevitable, considering how much BS was always undergirding this community, and how phony it has consistently been. I was always put off by silly New Agers preaching ascension, unicorn, and unrelenting positive speak. But now the love and light workers are preaching extremist QAnon hate. Going full wackadoo into conspiracy lunacy, they don't realize their campaign against Hollywood liberal blood-drinking pedophiles echoes Nazi propaganda. How did this happen? How is it possible that so many yoga teachers, mediums channeling galactic overlords, and wellness influencers suddenly became such utter morons? I have a theory. First, these New Age bubbleheads were trapped in a narcissistic happy place where no negativity could enter. In other words, they heavily invested in pretend worlds of star charts and sage so they didn't have to deal with their own shadow side. I'm getting Jungian. Life is messy. And these people are troubled and frustrated, like everyone living in these complicated times. But in their happy bubble of crystals and yoga fashion and thorough self-involvement, there is no place for confusion. No need to consider the fact that they feel angry and disoriented, or that they are possibly not superior beings. They are perfected. And they've never had to deal with the difficult emotions all of us normal slobs deal with. Taking ayahuasca is much easier. So up until now, they have avoided facing their dark side. But they are finally coming down to earth because things are getting exponentially more crazy these days, and reality is unavoidable. However, they are claiming the shadow self in the ugliest way possible by aligning with idiotic conspiracy hysteria. It makes sense to them, though. No matter if the malign myths change by the day, each revision getting more outlandish than the last. All true believers and cultists similarly make sense of such nonsense. The thing is, with life speeding up, aligning with a fictional world isn't sustainable. You eventually crash into the facts of reality. As a pure being, you believe you can fly, but when you jump off a two-story building, you will have a rude discovery as you crash into the fact of the pavement. At such moment, the wise will swallow their pride, admit their mistake, and move on. Perhaps not jump again. The thing is, self-involved cultists, full of ego, will double down with the big lie, and then jump off a four-story building, and a six-story, and so on, until they're annihilated. Whatever. Soon, there will be more crystals and sage and unicorns for the rest of us. Here's a list of New Age nincompoopery performed as something I've always wanted to be. A beat poet. Cacao ceremony, 5G, tarot, yoni eggs, feng shui, Kabbalah, 5D, portal to ascension, chemtrails, crop circles, pyramids, magic beads, incense, mantras, shamans from Latin America are so much more interesting than dull life in LA. Human reptiles, ancient aliens, extraterrestrials, ambassadors of the Galactic Federation, Lemurians, Atlanteans, Pleiadians, astrology, looking for the meaning of life in the sky rather than in the heart. Gene codes, light languages, indigo children, quantum, DNA, cellular word, porn. Release toxins, clean your gut with industrial chlorine. Alkaline foods, raw, vegan, celery juice, flat tummy lollipops, apple cider vinegar, superfoods, chia, maca, flax, golden flax, fasting, colonics, trying to purge the sins of self with self-punishment, like flagellating medieval monks, naked yoga, goat yoga, kundalini yoga, hot yoga taught by a demon, pay money to the guru, give sex to the guru, don't question his heinous ways, his abuse, his lies. Maybe in Siberia you'll find your master. I will not wear a mask. You will not silence my voice. You will not take my freedom. You will not implant your microchip into my brain. My voice, my freedom, my brain. Conspirituality, deep state, cabal, QAnon, follow the plan, stop the steal, George Soros, Rothschild, save the children from pedophilic, Hollywood, liberals drinking blood in underground tunnels. This is not a conspiracy. You're a conspiracy. This is truth. A last piece of advice. If anyone uses the following phrases, step away from the conversation. Galactic Federation. Love and light. I'm on a cleanse.
Ooh, yeah.
we are coming to the end of the show called Mystic Pete Chronicles. If you'd like to reach me, I'm at mysticpete.com. We started the show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone, followed by a talk by Dr. Justin Sledge. He has a YouTube channel called Esoterica, and an extended essay by me on the New Age and wellness community. The extraordinary vocals were by Akerke. Thanks for listening. Mystic Pete out!